Hello, and welcome to the second edition of the Missouri Review podcast. This month, Jason Koo, poetry editor for the magazine, interviews Derek Mung, winner of the 2006 Jeffrey E. Smith Editor's Prize Award for the poetry category. Derek Mung's poems featured in the magazine include Re Vitruvian Man, Speculum, Recoil, and To an Older Sibling Miscarried. Derek Mung was born in Portland, Oregon, but was raised outside Cleveland, Ohio, and educated at Denison University in Granville. He currently lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where he attends the University of Michigan's MFA program and teaches. In 2005, he received a Hopewood Award for a poetry manuscript in which To an Older Sibling Miscarried appeared. This summer, the Southern Review will publish a translation sequence he made from medieval Latin hymns. This edition of the Missouri Review, the spring edition of 2006, is his first publication.
Are you ready?
Where did you grow up, Derek?
I grew up outside of Cleveland, Ohio, actually, where you're from, in a little suburb south. Down 71, a place called Brecksville, Ohio, which is sort of a white picket fence, sort of a little closer. Yeah, white picket fence sort of town. It's got great schools and no diversity. And I didn't go too much further to get diversity when I went to college. I went to Denison University, which was, you know, in Granville, Ohio. But you know, we used to run into Cleveland on the weekends to, you know, live it up, I suppose.
Do you feel that growing up as a Clevelander has shaped your psyche as a poet?
Cleveland reminds me of St. Louis. I think someone, Kelly Wells, once told me, I'm going to say this as if I actually know Kelly Wells. I met her once at a reading, but I was asking her about St. Louis, and she said St. Louis is one of those towns that walks around with its sort of shoulders hunched and its head down a little bit. It's got that sort of like Midwestern, like, oh, ho-hum type feel. And Cleveland's got that too, you know. And you get that sort of impression that things are never quite right and are never going to sort of be the way that they once were. I mean, I know you're going to ask about the Indians at some point, but I think that, I mean, it's tied up with Cleveland sports too, right? You know, it's like the Indians won the World Series in, what, 1948 and have never come closer than Jose Mesa's, you know, ninth inning, you know, fumble. Yeah. Fumble. Fumble, yeah. Bad, wrong sport. Or, you know.
There was another fumble.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of what it is to grow up outside of Cleveland. Though it's, you know, you sort of, growing up in the suburbs, at least for me, I felt like I sort of adopted that feeling. And when I go someplace and tell someone, you know, I tell them I'm from Cleveland, and then they can recognize that. I can't tell them, you know, like, I'm from Brecksville. They don't understand what that means. And then there's a certain way in which you sort of take Cleveland's sort of hunched shoulders as your own, even though you sort of grew up in the burbs and that wasn't exactly the same thing. But that's something what Cleveland is like.
Has place been very important in writing poetry for you? Like, where you are, I mean, have you written a lot about Cleveland or where you're living now, Ann Arbor, or has it not been very important to your poetry?
It hasn't in terms of Ann Arbor. And it hasn't, I'm trying to think. When I was an undergraduate putting poems together, and I put a couple of poems together about Cleveland. I wrote about the river burning, which is, you know, another one of those things that Cleveland's never lived down, you know, the mistake on the lake with our, you know, too much oil. The place that's probably been most formative has been the West Coast. And I spent a summer in Berkeley to sort of escape a rural Ohio college experience. And I was doing a little Latin sort of 10-week thing. And that became a really big thing for me, to be able to sort of spend 3 months living in a city like Berkeley. And then every summer, my grandmother, bless her heart, takes the family out to Carmel, California. And, you know, we spend a week or 2 weeks sort of hanging out on the beach and going to Monterey and things like that. So I have a lot of poems that have Monterey in them and have Carmel and have the ocean. And I feel like I have to go back to the ocean every at least once a year. My folks now live out in Washington State near Portland, so I get to go out there and see the ocean. But I have to go back every like 6 months to a year, sort of like recharge my batteries in some way.
You mentioned Latin, which I didn't know about. Have you read much of the Latin and Greek poets in the original? And has that affected your young poethood?
I like how I have a young poethood. That's cool. Latin, yes. I mean, I can't read Greek, and I've never pushed myself to figure it out. And my Latin's not very good at all. I mean, it's the sort of Latin that poets have to sort of like make it through a text and sort of translate it and say that they've translated it a little bit. But it's yeah. I mean, learning Latin and being able to use Latin, use Latin source text has been probably the single most important thing in terms of broadening my sort of horizons as a writer. I love to do sort of translation things, and I sort of, well, I don't know if I certainly didn't coin this term, but I've sort of used this term. I like to do these sort of like four or five poem sort of sequences that are all sort of adaptations or sort of like voice variations or sort of some sort of takeoff on an initial Latin source text. And I did this once with like 11th century Latin hymns, like Peter Damian and Boethius and Alcuin and things like that. And I sort of take five texts that are a little bit different, and you sort of fluctuate the voice a little bit, and you change things in them, and you keep something and you toss something else out to make sort of a sequence and a little bit of like an arc. So that became really exciting. And it even just, I have a poem about Cicero and about the Bush administration and, you know, mixing in Latin and mixing in like things from that. Yeah. That base of knowledge has been really, really helpful.
Yeah. I mean, looking at all the poems that you submitted for a contest, they all seem very crafted, and I believe they're all written in meter in iambic pentameter to some extent, sort of loose pentameter at times, but you've broken up the lines a little bit to mask that, because I know many young poets are afraid of meter. But has your study of Latin and your background in that, has that affected your sense of the craft of poetry? Because obviously poets writing in, you know, the Latin language, it's a much more sort of meticulous, systematic prosody that ancient Roman poets have. So has that affected your approach to the craft of poetry?
The act of translating has certainly affected my attention to the craft of poetry, and that sort of weird way in which you occupy someone else's voice, but at the same time you're occupying your own, and you're sort of twisting and turning their words, often from a language, an inflected language, where the words are out of order and can be rearranged in any number of different ways. Yeah, syllabics has been sort of a really exciting thing for me. There's some way in which it foregrounds the materiality of language, and at least the materiality of sentences, where they have like the syllables are counted, and yeah, there's something about that I really find exciting. So,
what's interesting, you don't notice. it's kind of a nice thing to be able to fall into iambic pentameter quite naturally. But looking at the beginning of Recoil, you hear the beat pretty clearly. I taste it every time, thick as a pool of diesel fuel or varnish, smooth as smokehouse. So more power to you, I guess. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the genesis of this poem, Recoil, because it's such a fascinating scene that you describe here with yourself alone in your girlfriend's apartment, I think naked, holding a gun and sliding it along your thigh at one point, and imagining yourself as both victim and assassin. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the strange, warped psychology behind this poem, Derek.
This poem's got so many fun stories that go along with it that I have trouble. I've read it a few times, and I have trouble not, you know, prefacing it with all sorts of like, hopefully, you know, laugh generating sort of like anecdotes that precede it. It began when my first year in Ann Arbor, I was living in a beat up old house. A lot of the houses in Ann Arbor, beat up old houses, cut up into apartments. And my property manager's a real gun nut. And I was going to get my mail one day, and I heard him knock on his window, which was right above the mailbox. And he was like, "Hey, what are you doing?" And I was like, "Oh." And he's like, "You want to come look at my guns?" And I went inside, and he asked me to hold his assault rifle. And then he leaned it up against the wall that he shared with my apartment. And he's like, that's where I leave it all the time. I'm like, you don't lock it up? He's like, no, what if somebody comes in? And I was just like, oh, God, what if this thing goes off and these walls are paper thin and I get shot in the head in my sleep? The scene at the end of the poem, I mean, as with most poems, is partly fictitious and partly real. A girlfriend of mine a little while ago, her father kept a gun in a house that he had on the lake. And we would go and sort of spend afternoons down at this lake house. And it was exactly that. It was a black six shooter. And I can't remember if there were bullets in the there were. There were bullets in the desk. They weren't loaded in the gun. And I picked it up and I looked at it and I was like, well, this is uncomfortable. And why is this here? You know, you're out in the middle of nowhere. You don't need a gun. And I did not go into the bathroom and sort of look at it like that. But it seemed an appropriate way to sort of conclude the poem. And it felt maybe not cathartic, but at least culminating in some way.
Yeah. Both Recoil and To an Older Sibling Miscarried, you paint a scene, I guess that's sort of a loose way of putting it, but you seem to be interested in writing a sort of narrative-driven poetry that is not sort of, you know, you just telling a simple story in a very clear way, but in a very heightened way, setting the drama for this narrative of your own personal life, something that's happened to you personally. Is this something you're conscious of doing? Have poets like maybe Frank Bidart have been an influence for you in this way? That are also interested in these kind of dramatic narratives, and is writing a more extended kind of poem that will allow for this kind of narrative something that you're interested in doing?
Yes. I like to tell stories in poems. I like to tell personal stories. I love Frank Bidart, and I love to read, you know, the long monologues, all sorts of Bidart's work. I was talking to Ray McDaniel the other day in Ann Arbor, and I was actually reading Bidart in his office or waiting to go into his office. And he was like, oh, what do you do with Frank Bidart's grit? Because his poems can be a little grittier and sort of like turn you, which isn't something I feel like I do, though I would like to do in my work. Telling stories and painting sort of a picture of an experience. I picked up from David Baker as an undergraduate at Denison. David would always say, you know, it's never good enough for a story to be about one thing. It has to be about two. So I like to tell a story. I mean, Recoil is like this. It has a number of different experiences all related to guns or gunplay in some way. And through the sort of accumulation of all of these, you get a better sense of, you know, the narrator's experience with this particular event, this particular object, in terms of the poem Miscarried, it has a lot to do with just maybe painting a family portrait about what it means to have a miscarried child early on and what it means to sort of inherit that as sort of like a firstborn son, which has all these sort of things with it. My dad used to call me, oh, you're the number one A son and the number one B son or something like that. And he wasn't referring to the miscarriage, but, you know, it's having sort of being like the firstborn son is sort of an interesting thing culturally. But then to know that there was one before that didn't work out, I don't know if that really answers the questions about story, in fact, but yeah, that's a little about what that poem's about. Right now I have sort of a project of writing Sestinas about Fellini movies and that's just sort of a obsessive thing. I like Sestinas and I love Fellini movies, and there's a certain carnivalesque quality to a lot of his movies that I feel is suited to the Sestina. So I have three of those now, and my workshop mates begged me to not write any more because I was poised to write the La Dolce Vita Sestina about like everyone's Italian restaurant in their hometown being called La Dolce Vita or something, and you know, and this great movie, and I want to write one about 8.5, but I think I'll have to do that this summer when they won't have to read it.
What is your favorite Fellini movie?
The Satyricon, by far. My father, I don't want to say forced me to watch it, but asked me very sternly whether I would like to watch The Satyricon. And I was much too young. I think I was like 15 or 16. And this is a bawdy sort of like naked, run around the room, you know, Nero's Rome movie. And I didn't get it. And I had this quizzical look on my face, I'm sure, when it was all over. And he's like, okay, sorry about that. And then I watched it again 3 or 4 years later. And I was like, oh, wow, this movie's amazing. So I sat down to write a Sistine about it. So yeah, of course. Yeah, which is what everybody does. So the Satyricon is great. And I know your favorite is Knights of Cabiria. And I'd have to say that's probably maybe my second or third. I like Roma quite a bit, too.
You mentioned your manuscript. Do you have a tentative title for your manuscript, perhaps?
Oh, man. It, for a while, it was called What the Romans Called Farrago, which I think is a really... It's from the Fellini Sistina, the Satyricon one, which I liked. I liked the sound of it. But Linda Gregerson had told me as she was looking through the manuscript, you know, that's not... It sounds nice, but it's not an accurate rendering of your work because Farrago is like a hodgepodge or a cattle fodder or a mix of a whole bunch of stuff. And she's like, you know, that sounds like you being a bit paranoid about your work not matching up, because you got a lot of poems about, you know, your family, and then you've got a lot of sort of classically influenced translation work, and then you've got these weird Fellini things, but they all sort of actually talk to each other more than you think. So it didn't get that title. For a while, it was Such Breath Passed Through My Hands, and that sounded sort of sentimental, and the most recent version isn't any less sentimental, and I don't think I'll record it for you to know.
Do you have a sense of your subject matter? There's maybe a few things that you seem to obsess over more than others, besides, I guess, Fellini movies, or you seem to obsess over the body a little bit in a way that actually many poets seem to obsess over the body and mortality. But are there a sort of a... focus of subjects that you see recurring throughout your work?
My friend Britta Emil gave a beautiful introduction to a reading I did in Michigan, and she narrowed all of my work down. At one point in the introduction, she said, "Tonight's evening is brought to you by the letters I and O." It was great, like little Sesame Street moment. But she said that between those two letters, you can sort of break down all of my work. And I mean, this sort of first person narrator who wants to be the sort of emotional proxy to walk you through the poem is a big part of it. And then there's something about the O, the sort of coming back around, the sort of circle of the family in some way, the sort of oh my sense, or also like the lyric O. I have a poem called Ohio, and it's an etymology of Ohio. And at some point, there's a lot of wordplay, but it says something like, my home state can speed into a love cry or a lyric. Something like from a soul initial blooper, you know, like uh-oh to oh-oh. So, I mean, I really like that way of thinking about my work, and I'll have to steal it at some point and I have stolen it, in fact, right now.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I noticed, first of all, you have these smoke O's in your poem Recoil, and then you also have, in some way, the image of an O in the poem about the miscarriage, where you have this museum that you visit with the mannequins whose bellies were wide glass balls ballooning month by month. It has kind of an O image as well. And then there's the Vitruvian man in Da Vinci, who's kind of trapped in a circle, isn't he? So there's kind of an O, and then you kind of rub an O into this mirror in Speculum when you're clearing the steam from the mirror. You kind of... So there's something to that, I think, Derek.
This podcast is copyright 2006, The Missouri Review. No portion may be reproduced without express written permission by The Missouri Review. Visit us online at www.moreview.org. Podcast team is Chip Dubner, Seth Graves, Jay Kirby, Jamie Edding, and Danielle Stewart. The interview was provided by Jason Koo, poetry editor of The Missouri Review. Music was provided by Seth Graves. Thank you for listening.